Well, it is that time of year that, as any conscientious child will tell you, it's time to begin work on your Christmas list. Is that right, Izzy? Is it time to start? Time to start? Izzy's like, what? Hey, I wasn't expecting him to talk to me. Is it time to start? Time to start work on your Christmas list now? I mean, before even the back to school posters have come down, all the Christmas stuff's going to start appearing in the shops, isn't it? All the adverts will start sort of coming out on the TV, and it'll be that time when every good, sort of well-planned child will have sort of sat down and worked out what they want to ask for Christmas, what they're going to pester their parents for the latest toy or gadget. But I wonder what we really want. What would we choose if we could have anything at all? Would it be a long life, good health, youth, a new car, a new computer perhaps, a holiday home, a never empty bank account, guaranteed immunity from COVID-19. Even if we think that we've got absolutely everything, I suspect there's still something we would like if anything was available. In fact, that's the premise of many children's storybook, isn't it? The genie who grants the wishes. You know, that you can have anything you want, or three wishes will be granted. What would you ask for? But imagine if God gave you that choice. Not a genie, not a fantasy, but the almighty sovereign God. If he offered you the opportunity to have whatever you wanted, then what then? Well, that was the offer made to Solomon, the king, the son of King David. So we get to 1 Kings chapter 3. Solomon has recently taken his position on the throne of Israel, the throne which he inherited from his father David, who, we're told, rested with his ancestors and was buried in Jerusalem. And Solomon, it would appear, was in many ways like his father, a man after God's own heart, except that Solomon liked to make up some of his own rules. He might have worshipped God, but he worshipped in an odd way, because we read in chapter 3, verse 3, Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the instructions given to him by his father David, except, interesting little word there, isn't it, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. Now at this point, Solomon wasn't worshipping the idols, the false idols, but it was worship where worship was not supposed to take place at this time. It was worship that God had not sanctioned at this time. What was the problem? Well, when God's people had entered into the land of Canaan after their time of slavery, then they'd come back through the Red Sea, then spent time in the wilderness, then gone into the land of Canaan, they were supposed to do things differently from the people who were already in that land. They were supposed to do things God's way. But instead, they looked at some of the practices of the pagan Christians there, the Canaanites, such as their practice of setting up places of worship on the tops of mountains, and they thought, ooh, I quite like that. So why don't we do a bit of that ourselves? What can be the harm in that? Now, perhaps it does seem harmless to us, and it's actually what a lot of people do today. You know, oh, well, my God, they'll say. My God's like this. And their God might be a God that they've sort of taken some principles from Christianity, but then they've mixed in a few ideas from Buddhism, or there's a few New Age ideas thrown into the mix there as well. And they've created their own God. Well, where's the harm? Actually, there's plenty of harm in that, isn't there? You see, Solomon liked his wife. Well, actually, let's be honest, Solomon liked his wives. At the beginning of chapter 3, he makes an alliance with the king of Egypt, and he marries his daughter, a pagan girl. And she comes into the palace, and he allows her to bring her pagan practices as well into the royal palace. Well, look, you know, Solomon's been sort of fairly sort of, you know, relaxed about the high places. What's the harm in this? Do you see how it starts to kind of get a little bit more, a next step, another compromise? It didn't end there. By the start of chapter 11, we discover that King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them. Because, why had God said they mustn't do it? Because they will surely turn your heart after their gods. Oh, that won't happen to us. At home, we've got our second big black hairy beast. Hector the dog. I was never going to have a dog. I didn't like dogs. I didn't want a dog. My life was perfectly good without dogs. I bought our first dog as a present for Liz. Because I just knew I was going to, you know, I wasn't going to win that battle in the end. And the same when, you know, the time came to adopt Hector from the rescue people. And I was shown the little picture. I said, oh, he's so sweet. I thought, there's no point fighting this. He's going to come and live with us. Because that's what happens, isn't it, when you get married? When you get married, you make compromises with each other. You start off with all these things. This is the things I do. This is the thing I do. You get married and you will make compromises. And you will find yourself agreeing to things you never thought you were going to agree to. But that's marriage. And that's what happened to Solomon. And they turned his heart after their gods. His wives in this way led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. His heart wasn't fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed, we're told, Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonites, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. You see, what started off as a, you know, sort of a bit of independent thinking, by the end has turned into full-scale rebellion against God. And Solomon ends his life knowing that his enemies are circling, ready to snatch the kingdom away, because God has removed his blessing from him because of Solomon's unfaithfulness. And all this is a pity, because Solomon showed such promise. The passage that we heard read this morning speaks of Solomon's great wisdom. When God asked what his heart's desire was, when God offered to grant him one thing that Solomon wanted, the new king answered with incredible maturity. Solomon recognized that God had blessed his father David because David was faithful to God. Solomon knew that part of that blessing was allowing him, his son, to inherit the throne. Solomon, of course, wants that to continue for his son. He says to God, but I'm only a little child. I don't know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you've chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. Well, look, Solomon might be a little bit daunted, but he knows what's required. So he asks God this. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? Solomon knows he needs wisdom to carry out his official duties. And God is pleased with him for asking that. God grants him that because Psalm 111 tells us that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Solomon realizes that he's got this responsibility to live out a life that reflects being a man of God, and he needs God's help with that. Solomon has asked for the right thing. God rewards him with wisdom and gives him, you know, wealth and honor as well, as long as he remains faithful. And as we know, by the end of Solomon's life, because he hasn't been faithful, those things are slipping away. Well, the immediate result, though, is that Solomon goes down in the history books as the wisest of all kings. The verses following this is the famous story of the wise ruling with the two women and the baby that they're both claiming as their own. If you don't know that story, I'll leave you to read that when you get home. A bit of homework for you. But suffice to say, by the end of the following chapter, we read that God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. And we're told that when all Israel heard the verdict that the king had given, they held the king in awe because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Solomon's wisdom was greater than wisdom that any of the other kings in the east possessed. We're told this, he was wiser than anyone else. Now we don't know who these people are, okay, but they're obviously known in the day. If Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Kelcol, and Dada, the sons of Mahol, and his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He spoke about plant life, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also spoke about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. From all nations, people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who'd heard of his wisdom. Basically, Solomon is the 970 BC Google. If you want to know what something is, you ask Solomon. You know, it was kind of like, you know, he's greater than all these other things, greater than sort of, you know, Ask Jeeves, or, you know, who can remember the other search engines has gone by the wayside. He's the one to go to. It sounds impressive, but remember, we know that actually just niggling and gnawing away at Solomon, there's an inconsistency between his public life and his private life. Publicly, Solomon is full of wisdom. Everyone's coming to ask his opinion on things. He glorifies God through his words and his actions. But privately, he's very unwise. He's allowing his heart to become corrupt and greedy, not only for women, but for false gods. As we look at Solomon, we're reminded how easy it is for us to present one face to the world, but have a very different private persona. You know, the media loves, doesn't it? It loves those stories where you've got someone who outwardly appears to be, you know, good and kind and generous and wise, but inwardly, suddenly another side appears to them. You know, the great stories have been, haven't they, over the last 18 months, you know, so-and-so who says this about coronavirus, particularly in the government, but they behave like this in private. You know, be it, you know, relationships you shouldn't be having with your staff, to driving to Barnard Castle to test your eyesight. Those have been the people that the media has loved to sort of tear down, because they've said one thing and done another. Well, you know, look, perhaps we're not that bad. But Solomon's life is a cautionary tale. We might seem to have a close relationship with God. We might appear to the world and even kid ourselves that we're wise and godly in our dealings. But it's very easy to be led away from God in our personal life and to become idolaters and sinners. And that undermines everything else and turns us into hypocrites. Solomon's weaknesses began with that little concession, that except he worshipped at the high places. It seemed insignificant. But God knew the danger that those pagan altars possessed. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, God had commanded, "This is what you're to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire." Chapter 12, verses 2 to 3. "Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every spreading tree, where the nations you're dispossessing worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, burn their Asherah poles in the fire, cut down the idols of their gods, and wipe out their names from those places." God had been really clear. When you come into this land, you must not worship the Lord your God in their way, Deuteronomy 12. But you're to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes, to put his name there for his dwelling. Because God had spelled out the danger, hadn't he? Being drawn away. A very real danger for our spirituality. Doesn't really matter. It's only a small compromise. It won't have a big effect. But it becomes a drip, 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 drip that eventually causes the ceiling to cave in and destroys your faith. Wisdom like that of Solomon isn't actually beyond us. We can have the wisdom that he asked for. If we fear the Lord, if we recognise who he is and submit to his authority alone in our lives, then we too can and truly will be wise, allowing his word to soak into our hearts and direct all that we do and say. But it must be all. That's where Solomon went wrong. He received God's wisdom, but then he overruled it with his own ideas, his own thoughts, his own wisdom, which was not wise at all. We can't live with double standards. We can't be godly to the world, but sinful and rebellious in our private lives. By the end of his life, Solomon is exposed as foolish and selfish and greedy. And we too will be laid bare before God's all-seeing gaze. So we need to constantly keep watch on ourselves and on each other. That's one of the great things about meeting together as church, that we can encourage each other, we can go to each other for help, and we can sometimes spot one another going off on the wrong track, and we can go, hey, come on, we need to talk about this. We need to get back on track with God. We need to trust in his commands and his instructions, conscious that those little concessions we make to godlessness can be the thin end of the wedge or the start of the slippery slope. And when we're tempted, we need to humbly turn back to God and make him the centre of our lives and the sole incumbent of our hearts. We need to be wise enough to confess our sins to God and to seek his forgiveness through Christ. Because only when we fear the holiness of God will we be wise enough to trust in his salvation. Amen.